Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. Of course, we welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us this evening a very, very special guest, and I think you'll find this a fascinating story. Walid Shubat was a Palestinian who was a terrorist, and I've heard some wonderful stories from people who've heard him tell, give his testimony. So I'm not really going to do much of anything. I'm just going to let him get started talking, and thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Steph, for having me.
Well, why don't you just tell our listeners, sort of tell them who you are, how it was that you came to know the Lord. But first of all, what was it like, being a Palestinian, certainly being raised with all the frustration I'm sure many of the Palestinian people feel, and the efforts to create this constant antagonism between the Palestinians and Jews. So you pick the story up.
All right. Your hatred develops like a drug addiction, from stone throwing to Molotov cocktails to ending up planting a bomb, as I did. My family background, from my father's side, were good friends with Hajj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Now, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, for your listeners, he was a conspirator with Hitler to destroy the Jewish people in the Muslim Arab world. You can see a photo of Hajj Amin al-Husseini in the eve of the Final Solution. He also created one of the Nazi SS divisions. Now remember, the Nazi war machine has 8 divisions. One of them is a Muslim division, the Bosnian division, which destroyed hundreds of thousands and destroyed 90% of the Jews in Bosnia. So the family's connection from the father, the ties were pretty much terroristic. My mother's side, she's an American. She happened to fall in love with a Palestinian, my father, in a university here. And then went there for a visit, to visit my ailing grandmother. And the ticket was destroyed. She was never allowed to go back. And she ended up being stuck in Bethlehem for 35 years or so, almost 40 years. And her plight is a whole story altogether. And she had to watch her children growing in that society. She couldn't say much. She converted to Islam, not knowing what Islam was. And in the process of living there, she saw the facts about Islam and the lifestyle and everything else. She became a Christian secretly. She was baptized in the YMCA in Jerusalem, in the pool. And she had to kind of endure watching me going to school, learning what I'm learning, going to violent demonstrations, end up in prison, throwing stones at the rabbis down at the Wailing Wall, putting a bomb in Bank Naomi, Israel, in Bethlehem, and near lynching Israeli soldier. I had many of my relatives got killed. She had to endure my Quranic education, my Islamic education, jihad, and the plan of destroying the enemy, who is the Judeo-Christian culture, basically. Even after I finished high school, I ended up coming to the United States, getting involved with Islamist groups here.
And then now, what year was that just about?
That was in the beginning of the 80s.
Okay.
Islamism was growing strongly in Chicago.
And, of course, this is the thing I think it's so important for our listeners to realize, that this Islamic movement has been here. Our government knew that. And if you haven't seen that wonderful video on jihad in America, you really need to, and you'll understand why it was suppressed. They didn't want the American people to know that this really was this violent Islamic movement here, certainly in the late 80s. And you're saying it was here really in the early 80s.
Well, that's right, early 80s. As a matter of fact, our recruitment was coming from Jordan. The recruiters were coming from Jordan. Had connections with Mustafa Azzam, the recruiting agent. He's still in Chicago, as a matter of fact. He's still alive and well, operating in Chicago. Surprisingly, they still haven't been arrested. And if you see this education, was under the ground, in basements, and all kinds of things. We were prepared to launch a jihad in America. And then I moved to California. I kind of got disenfranchised with the Islamic movement because I was used to listening to music. Music was forbidden. You have to understand the brainwash. You know, you got to get up at the wee hours of the morning.
I laugh because I remember being in Amman in Jordan, you know, as an American tourist, and what is it, 4:30 in the morning when the imam comes out and starts broadcasting on the loudspeaker system.
Yes, wakes you up.
Right, it sure does.
You know, it's Americans are not used to it. So, in 1993, I took a turn. I was married to a Catholic lady. And I was converting her to Islam at the process, and she told me, "Oh, you said that the Jews corrupted the Bible. Can you show me what are the evil things the Jews introduced to the Bible?" So I started a study. I bought a Bible for $10. And I was fascinated with the story of David. Because here David committed adultery with Bathsheba, killed Uriah the Hittite, her husband. And then Nathan, the prophet, comes and he tells him, you know, he tells him the story of this person who did such a thing, and David says this man should die. And Nathan told him, that man are you. So he was in the Bible, David's sin exposed. And I couldn't fathom that, because in the Quran, it does not expose any sin of any prophet. Prophets are all almost sinless. Then I remember the story, looking at the Quran, the story of Muhammad, who took his adopted son's wife as his wife, and made null and void adoption in Islam. So here you have this case where Allah, the God of the Quran, have allowed this thing to happen, and it was not called sin, it was blessed. And Muhammad had his son Zayd divorce his daughter-in-law, so he can take her to his bed. So at this point, the journey started to thinking, say, wait a minute, let me look at the mirror here. I got sins of my own. So I started understanding that the Bible was a mirror. And then I started understanding Jewish culture, music, songs, and I remember buying Fiddler on the Roof, all these things. And I found fascinating in the Bible that there is 8,352 verses of prophetic nature. I found out that there's a roadmap, if you will, that God had a roadmap. And he had his roadmap written from thousands of years ago. You know, the volume was collected in 66 books by 40-some prophets, and it was incredible. I studied it from cover to cover. I'm doing a book currently, Why I Left Jihad, over 350 pages of documentation of what I found, basically, in the Bible, regarding that one nation, Israel, that I hated so much. And regarding the end times, and regarding what is going to happen in the coming arena of the world. I found out that every nation in the Bible mentioned in end times that gets cursed, or gets destroyed, or gets reprimanded is a Muslim today. Every single one that's mentioned in scripture, I found out it was to be Muslim. And I urge anybody to say differently. Tell me that there's a Western country mentioned that's being destroyed at end times. Spain is mentioned, Rome is mentioned in the New Testament, but never mentioned for destruction. countries like Ethiopia is mentioned, but if you go to the Hebrew, it's Cush. And if you go to the Bible dictionary, Cush is the Sudan, which killed 2 million Christians. The kings of the East are mentioned as to be China. But if you go to kings of the East in the New Testament, last I know, there was kings of the East that visited Jesus when he was an infant to present him with frankincense and gold and myrrh. These were from Babylonia and Persia. Today is a Muslim country today. So why can't the kings of the East be Muslim? So I started documenting my findings and started becoming active to speaking to others. And I remember I was doing a prayer before I started this whole research. I had prayed in the name of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that God will show me the truth, will show me the path that he wants me to go. And for the whole time during my research, I had thought that for sure the Quran would win this research. And it ended up otherwise. How could you refute 8,352 verses written in the Bible of prophetic nature telling us God's roadmap in every detail? Israel will come back to the land. It did. There will be mass slaughter of the Jewish people. There is. There will be mass slaughter of Christians. There's more Christians dying today than any other time in history. And you look at Revelation and I saw the martyrs who were beheaded in the name of Jesus, and you turn on the TV and they're beheading Christians in Iraq and Saudi Arabia. And see, what in the world is going on? Abu Sayyaf in Philippines beheads Christians. So we're living in a time that the lack of information on the facts is no excuse. The facts are there. The war is there. There is a war against the Judeo-Christian society as a whole. If you look at the letter that was sent by this woman for Johnson's beheading to his family, very obscene stuff. The war is there, but the American government is not telling us much because they don't want instability in the country. It had to be so obvious that these planes had to ram into these buildings. And from 1993, I remember, I became a Christian. And I started going around the churches, and I started speaking in these churches. I started telling them, they're going to behead you. They're going to blow up your buildings. They're going to terrorize you.
Now, this was 1993 you started up the church. Right?
Yes. And what people used to tell me, excuse me, we're busy dealing with cults. We're busy with Jehovah's Witnesses, we're busy with Mormons, we're busy with this and that. I said, excuse me, you have no clue about this coming cult. This is the cult. Nothing like anything you ever thought of. And people were unaware. I remember September 11, you know, my phone was ringing all day. How did you know? Excuse me, we were planning a jihad in America. What are you talking about? How did I know? Sorry.
Okay. No, you'll go right ahead. I'm fascinated by, you know, of course, you anticipated this. Everybody should have anticipated it, but everything was done ready to play the threat down. We never saw it on television, and when there were programs that could have shown it, like the video Stephen Emerson's Jihad with America, somebody actively suppressed that, so the American people were just totally asleep, and little wonder they were amazed on the September 11th, 2001, but they shouldn't have been, because it had been long-term planning, and of course I believe that there are people who knew it was going to happen, but nothing was done. That's a great tragedy.
Yeah, zippo, nothing. As a matter of fact, Stephen Emerson is right on, when Jihad in America. He did this investigation, and it was supposed to be broadcast, and then all of a sudden, had to be removed.
Right. Now, incidentally, for our listeners out there, it's taken me about 3 years, but I finally got a supply of those videos. That's called Jihad in America, and you want to know more about them, why they give us a call afterwards. But you pick up the story from there. So basically, then you went around and telling people, and nobody wanted to hear, and then, of course, here we have the 9/11 attack, and then everybody's up in arms. So what's going to happen now? It's certainly such a tragic situation over in Israel today. American pressure on Israel has actually resulted in forcing them to give up some 95% to 97% of the land that they had in the idea of they're going to get peace, and it doesn't look like there's going to be any peace over there, no matter what the Israeli government does. Is that your impression?
That's my impression. There is man's roadmap, and we have one in Israel. And there's God's roadmap. You know, there is a roadmap that's been set from long ago. And believe it or not, that roadmap that God has planned in the Bible will be fulfilled to the uttermost. Every single jot and tittle is going to be fulfilled. I see exactly the formation of the country that Ezekiel 38 mentioned. As a matter of fact, I was preaching even Turkey will become Muslim. And people were laughing at me. They said, Turkey is a secular country. What are you talking about? Now the Islamists won in Turkey. And they don't have the support of the generals. They don't have support of the military. If they do get the support of the military, you have one of the largest armies in the Northern Hemisphere. Turn Muslim fundamentalist. So you have, you know, there's Meshach and Tubal. That's who these people are. It's from the Caspian Sea and the Black, between the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea. And all the states that have left the USSR, the five states, the CIS, the Commonwealth of Independent States. These are Muslim states. The Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, all these towns. These are Muslim countries. And they're finding the unity with Iran and Turkey is better, more plausible than being part of the West. In fact, there's an alliance now between Turkey and seven other Muslim countries. So what do you do with this information? You know, it's there. It fits perfectly with what we've been warned long ago.
And you know what's the most amazing thing is that the leaders of Turkey, the military leaders, really want, of course, to become part of NATO, to become part of the West.
Right.
They don't want to see their country dragged back into the radical Islamic beliefs. But they're being rejected by the countries of Europe, and as a result, they're being forced to return really to Islam. And I think it's only a matter of time before some of the officers have another coup, and the radical Islamic leaders take over. Right today, the parliament in Turkey is under the control of the people who embraced the original form of Islam. Some people call it Islam, radical Islam. Other people call it traditional Islam. Well, how should we refer to it? Because many Muslims would like to live peacefully, but of course there are those who would return to the ways of the Prophet.
Well, you know, I never knew the word Wahhabi Islam going in the Middle East. It was Islam. Jihad is jihad. There is no form of self-struggle or the struggle within. If you look at the compilation of the hadiths or the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, 99% of them are jihad by the sword. And there's only one saying that says, now I resort to the jihad, the struggle that is within. I had an apologist, Khalil Muhammad, the other day in a symposium, kind of debate with me, and he said to me, come on, Walid, tell the world that jihad means self-struggle. Jihad doesn't mean war. So my response was very simple. I thought about it and paused on it. I said, yes, you're right. Jihad does mean self-struggle, but so does Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf means my self-struggle, my struggle. If that's the way you want to look at it, this is the jihad of Mein Kampf, and it's all through the Islamic world. The tribes of Banu Nadir, Banu Qaynuqa, Banu Qurayda in Saudi Arabia were vanished. The Banu Qurayda were beheaded. And we proudly studied this in school. It's not something that you want to expose to a Muslim and say, look, you know, Islam teaches this. You better be aware of this. They know that.
But
we know that. And if you look at the fact that all this quarrel between the Islamic apologists who are supposed to be saying they're peaceful Muslims, their quarrel is not with terrorists. Their quarrel is with Islamophobics like me and you. They only want to fight Islamophobics. They only want to fight anybody who comes and exposes what is the meaning of Islam. What are they doing about Sudan? Nothing. Will they demonstrate with you to go to something with, for human rights? No, they won't. No, they won't. They will do nothing about human rights. They will never walk with your human rights campaign. In fact, I told Khalil Muhammad, I said, do you denounce the killing of the Jews of Khaybar of Saudi Arabia by the Prophet Muhammad? He says, of course, you know, I cannot denounce that. Because if he denounces that, he denounces Islam. You have to understand, Islam is not for personal, a religion or for personal use. It is a religion and a form of government, just like communism, just like Nazism.
In fact, there are really some very, very definite parallels between the Nazis and the leaders of the Islamic movement. In fact, the leaders of the Islamic movement worked very, very closely with Adolf Hitler, and this is what most Americans don't understand. But then most Americans don't really understand much of what's going on today. We'll be back here in just a moment with our fascinating guest. If you have a question, don't hesitate. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Waleed Shubat, and we're talking about what's going on as far as the Islamic world is concerned. Do you have a feeling that really this growing militancy within the Islamic world, it's increasing much more than it would have been, say, 20 years ago, or are we just about the same place?
Well, when I left Israel, I remember the Muslim community, it wasn't that fundamentalist. I used to go to the local mosque, and there'd hardly be a dozen people, mostly elderly men, praying in the mosque. And when I went there last time, 15 years ago or so, it was packed. There was no place to sit. And all young. Girls were all covered from head to toe. It was incredible, absolutely upside down.
Well, you know, Chris, we've seen some videos of, what they're showing on Arab TV, and it's trying to incite the people to violence and even targeting the children to get them to join this radical, movement and to become warriors and kill themselves or become suicide bombers. I was shocked when I saw some of that material being shown on Arab TV. Have you seen any of that?
Oh, yes, I saw a lot of these things. I have to watch some of these things, especially the work I do. You have teaching that of Dracula, Count Dracula now is Sharon, and he's the rabbis of Israel are killing Palestinian children and bottling their blood in Coca-Cola cans.
No, this is what they're telling them.
And that's a cartoon. We have a whole cartoon show showing this. Kids see, watch the series. Things that you never even imagined, even Nazi Germany would not even put on TV. This is going on not just in Abu Dhabi or Dubai or Saudi Arabia. This is going on in 55 Muslim states with education.
And I think that's really what's so frightening. I think that most Americans don't understand. We're dealing with somewhere between, 1.25 billion and 1.5 billion. About how many Muslims are there in the world? Do we have any idea?
Well, last I heard was 1.2 billion.
1.2 billion, okay.
And increasing. The largest country is in Indonesia. And in Indonesia, millions of books have been sold to the school children. The text comes from Saudi Arabia, from the Saudi government. The Saudi government, Saudi Arabia, is the one that launched this education throughout the Muslim world. This is why I think Saudi Arabia is the harlot of Babylon, because you have this country that is spewing out this and spending one third of its wealth on this education system to the whole world, to the whole Muslim world. And the United States considers Saudi Arabia a friend.
Well, what really bothers me is the fact that they're actually sending their missionaries to the United States, to the mosques, most of which they've actually built here in the United States, into our prisons, and they're recruiting people into this violent form of religion, which is, contains an intense hatred of America and of the Jews and of everything we stand for.
That's right. In the Muslim motto, do unto non-Muslims what Muslims will never want to do to themselves. They will not mind coming here and building madrasas and Islamic cultural center. But the moment you mention, this is what I told Dr. Khalil Muhammad in the symposium. I said, excuse me, would you allow Christian missionaries in Saudi Arabia? And he was irate. Would you allow Christians to visit Saudi Arabia? And he was irate. So it's okay for them to come here and build these schools and their fanatic schools and mosques. Ironically speaking, the mosque that the last arrest was, it was called Masjid As-Salam, the Mosque of Peace.
Well, hold that thought, because we're going to have to bring our other stations back here and be joining us in just a moment now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Waleed Shubat, and we're talking about really what's happening throughout the world, and as Waleed's contention that and I certainly concur, that Saudi Arabia, our so-called friends, are spending a tremendous amount of their money, about a third of their income, pressing this Wahhabi, this radical form of belief, all throughout the world, and printing textbooks that are sent into Indonesia, into Nigeria, and to all the various Muslim countries, inflaming the youth, training them in this radical form and radical Islamic beliefs, built upon hatred and violence, but even more frightening is the effect they're having right here in the United States. where they're, of course, funding our mosques, they're funding Islamic schools, they're funding the imams who go into our prisons and are recruiting there out of the prisoners, predominantly black prisoners, people, and getting them to hate America. Now, why in heaven's name would any country allow that sort of thing to be going on? That's not, has nothing to do with freedom of speech in times like this. This is frank subversion, and yet, of course, nobody speaks out against it.
That's right. In fact, you mentioned black Islam. If anything, the black community in America should reject the Islamic religion, because slavery, you know, a lot of the slavery that even happened here, there were people who were sold into slavery, happened by Arab merchants who were selling slaves. If you look at the slavery in Sudan, they're buying slaves from Sudan, young girls who are being exported and, you know, to become prostitutes. If anything, Jesse Jackson should be irate. If Jesse Jackson really cared about the black Americans and the black community of the world, why is he not doing anything about what's happened in Sudan?
Well, Jesse Jackson's sort of a caricature, in my estimation. I think he is sort of put up there as a leader for the black people, and he's selling them out. I think most of the black people are smart enough to realize that. I think it's just the white people who aren't smart enough to realize that.
Yes, and, you know, I'm afraid that they will come, you know, they will radicalize the black Muslim community, and they will be used as agents to carry out the jihadist will.
And, of course, you know, we see what happens to the moderate Muslims living in Palestine today. If you don't want to go along with the jihad, they just simply kill you over there.
As a matter of fact, yeah, Hajj Amin al-Husseini killed 11 chieftains, Muslim chieftains, in the territory. My grandfather was supposed to be one of them. His life was spared because my father-in-law fought for Abdul Qadir al-Husseini and Hajj Amin al-Husseini. So his life was spared in the last minute. He was killing all the clergy that didn't agree with him.
And I think this is one of the most amazing things, is that the more traditional form of Islam will kill the other Muslims who don't agree with them. In fact, that's what we're seeing in the Sudan today. The black Muslims, and they're living in the western part of the Sudan, they're being killed by the militant Muslims out of the eastern part. And so here you see Muslim killing Muslim. Before it was Muslim killing Christian, and now it's Muslim killing Muslim. It almost seems like violence is part and parcel of the religion.
That's right. To me, Islam is Islam. There is no two Islams. There is Muslim fundamentalist, there is Muslim secularist. The secularists really don't adhere so much into Islam. They don't look deep into Islam. They're not really interested in becoming that religiously Islamic. They like their fasting, they like to give alms, they like to wash and pray five times a day. These are your secular Muslims. But truly, if I have a debate between Osama bin Laden and the secular Muslim, Osama bin Laden will be easily able to bring out sources from the Hadith and the Quran to substantiate his view. So to me, Islam is Islam. There is no, you know, same as Christianity. Christianity is Christianity. You can disagree on certain aspects or certain doctrine or certain interpretation, but when Muhammad, the Prophet of Islam, says whoever leaves the faith, kill him, what part of kill is allegoric? It is not an allegoric killing.
No, and I think that,
why am I in hiding? If Islam is a peaceful religion, why am I in hiding? Why, you know, why are Christians being killed? It's not because the fundamentalists hijacked your religion. This is the problem, you see. George Bush saying that Islam is a peaceful religion. A peaceful religion was hijacked. In the Quran it says whoever kills a life kills the whole world. Whoever destroys a life destroys the whole world. Whoever saves a life saves the whole world. But they never continue the text. Continue the text, go further. What does it say? For an unjust cause or for doing mischief in the land. And for the ones who do mischief in the land, cut their hands and their feet from opposite ends and crucify them. Never continue the text. Continue the text, you'll see it.
Well, I know it's really one of the most amazing things is that there in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, where they have beheadings and chopping off hands and feet every week, and everybody comes out to see it, sort of like going to the football to
Chop Chop Square.
When was the last time you saw that on television? And of course, you're never going to see that on television today, because they're controlling your perspective. Oh, we terrible things going on in Afghanistan. We wanted to justify our war. But, of course, we never show that about Saudi Arabia. Of course, maybe we will when we're ready to go to war there. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Waleed Shubat. And am I pronouncing your word right?
Shubat, that's right.
Shubat, okay.
I like to say Shubat and Abbas together, one word.
Okay. And now, of course, as far as, did you have a website or some means that people can get in touch with you?
Yes, I do have Shubat.com.
Shubat.com.
S-H-O-E-B-A-T. Just like a shoe and a bat, one word put together, .com.
All right, Shubat.com.
Shubat.com, yes. I have material there. We have CDs. We have an initiative to change the universities in America. We're going to be speaking at universities in America. I've been speaking all over. Because I see the youth as the biggest danger here. The youth is being hijacked. So we need to go into the youth and it will energize America back the way it should be. So I have a ministry for the Christian churches as well to understand God's plan for Israel and God's plan for us as well as believers. And I speak at the synagogues. And as I mentioned also, I'm doing a book right now, Why I Left Jihad. In it, I just documented in detail the thousands of reasons why we're on the right track.
All right, well, I hope when you get the book done, well, you can get us a copy, and then we'll do some programs. And I do want to get you on our other programs. We do about 5 hours of talk radio a day, so at least the three separate audiences, and actually we have a weekend program as well. And I think your message is so important. You know, as I look at Israel today, and of course, we've been there many times and spent many trips to Bethlehem, and of course now it really isn't hardly safe to go into Bethlehem at all. In fact, it's really not a very safe country to visit unless you stay right within the confines of Israel. You know, in years past, where we were able to travel and travel freely all throughout the land, and now it seems that everybody's being pushed in behind the fence, which of course is equally true for both the Palestinians and for the Israelis. Do you see a continued conflict there?
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, in Bethlehem, mentioning Bethlehem, 80% of the Christians have left Bethlehem. There's no more, hardly any Christian living there. The 500 or so stores that were owned by Christian families are all being taken by Muslims. The robbing of the Christian stores. There's a good CD called Christians in Peril that talks about that. Once you pass Rachel's Tomb in Bethlehem, you're pretty much on your own. Good luck surviving. And if I go back to Bethlehem, I'd be lynched in 5 minutes. My family wants me. They want me dead or alive, you know, or alive to be killed. I lost all my land, lost all my property, lost every member in my family. I finally understood what the text says. It says, you know, you will lose lands, you will lose your mother, father, and everything.
Hold that thought for just a moment as our stations come back with us.
Yes, sir.
Well, I guess this evening is Waleed Shubat, and we're talking about his situation. He's, of course, lost everybody in his family. As a Muslim, if you leave the Muslim faith, why, you are to be killed, and your family is to kill you. And, of course, he cannot go back again. He can't go back to his homeland. So, of course, he's here in America talking to the churches, trying to go into the universities, where we have so many young people who are being disillusioned with everything about America. And this is why we have people like that, what was his name, Johnny Walker, whatever it was, who went over there to join the Taliban to fight against America, and why other Americans are being recruited into the Muslim faith. There are lots of things wrong with America, but there are lots of things that are right with America. And what we need to do is give our young people something to believe in, teach them about Christianity, give them a sense of hope and identity. That's not what they're learning in our schools today. And unfortunately, they're not even learning that in many of our churches. But we need to get them, oriented and oriented right. Because, of course, once you realize that each one of us is a unique human being, made in the image and likeness of God, and God created us, that kid's given the greatest self-esteem of all time. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you'd like, of course, to speak to our guest this evening, he understands the Muslim faith firsthand because he was raised as a Muslim. He was a Muslim terrorist. And then, of course, he began to read the Bible and began to realize what an amazing document it is. And I think that probably it is this concept that there's prophecy there. God has a plan. You can see it worked out in past centuries. You can see it being laid out and coming to pass right today. In fact, there's no way to explain all of the amazing things that are there that we see today. You have to certainly have a tremendous amount of faith not to believe in what I believe, of course, is the truth of God's Word. So what sort of response do you get when you go onto the universities?
It's a very positive response. We're winning the arena. I just went to UCLA a month or so ago, and you can read about it in the internet. There was a little demonstration there against me to speak up in the university, and it was fascinating because as soon as I got to the podium, I started thinking. I said, "Why do I have a demonstration against me?" So I said, "When I used to be a Palestinian terrorist, I was called a freedom fighter. But now that I have no hatred toward the Jewish people, I'm called a racist." Go figure, you know. Now I have no problem with Americans. Actually, it's a survival issue for me because this country is the only place. Have you been to Europe lately? I don't want to live in Europe. This is the only place where people like me can survive. This is the country where I want my children to survive. I want to break this yoke, this chain of hatred. And I want my kids to come out and living normal life. So this is the country that is protecting me. And I have a duty and obligation towards this country.
And you know, really, as we had a talk this afternoon with a gentleman from Great Britain, in fact, he was a vicar from Cambridge, England. And he was saying that, you know, in England today, about 2% of the people there are Christian. And even on the continent, it's only about 4 or 5% at the very most. Other than that, it's either agnostic or, frankly, anti-Christian. Here in America, at least, we have that tremendous reservoir of Christianity, although both the Catholic and the Protestant churches are under vicious attack today. They've been infiltrated, and, of course, the faith is changing, and they've changed the music, they've changed the message of our churches, and they are being used ready to change the world, but
yes,
not necessarily going along with the gospel, but the new gospel, which is being preached today.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, you're talking about England. I did a tour in Great Britain, and it's spoken at 18 different outlets, media and schools and events. And one of the interesting one was when I walked into the BBC. And unfortunately for them, they put it live. They had a panel of three people interviewing me live. And I said to them, I just explained to you that what's happening in the Middle East is similar to what happened in Nazi Germany. They said, well, Israel, what did Israel do wrong? You must mention things that Israel did wrong. And I said, well, are you saying it takes two to tango in Nazi Germany? Did it take two to tango in the Holocaust? And the guy said, yes. I said, what did the Jewish people do to deserve the Holocaust? That was in the BBC. And the other guy wanted to help one of the panelists there, and he said, all you fundamentalists are the same. I said to him, sir, you're right. The fundamentalists are the same in one way. Christians could give the world a headache by knocking on the door preaching the gospel. You're right. We give people a headache. But a Muslim fundamentalist will take your head right off your shoulders, sir, and think nothing of it. Well, thank you for stopping at the BBC. You have to escort me out real quick.
And of course, really, it's amazing the anti-Christian bias, almost the hatred of Christianity there. I had the opportunity one time of being on a talk show, the largest talk show in all of Great Britain, originating in England, and I really had a great time there for about 10 minutes talking about what was going on, because they were having demonstrations against the World Trade Organization or some similar organization that was there. I simply pointed out the similarity between what was happening there and what had happened in Seattle. But, of course, I was doing fine until I got to the end of the program and I talked about the spiritual aspect of what was going on. And then I, of course, left, and I got calls later telling me that, you know, for 20 or 30 minutes afterwards, people were calling in and condemning me because I professed Christianity on the radio. And this intense hatred of Christianity, which has gripped what once was a great Christian nation. In fact, so many of our people here in the United States actually came from England and from English heritage and from the product of the Protestant Reformation. And boy, you'd sure never know that in England today. They've done a pretty good job of destroying Christianity there. And, of course, they're doing everything
right.
They can to destroy it here. And I think your message is so important, because what we have to do is, I think the idea that people read the Bible and they see that prophecy coming to pass, mm-hmm. it gives them a whole different perspective.
The falling away must come first. And what's happened in England and Europe was falling away. We're concentrating, looking at Europe as the Antichrist, yet this is what falling away is. And I believe that Muslim world is going to be the military mechanism that's going to be the biggest danger on earth. But indeed, we see the falling away happening even here. Twisting of biblical scripture, and this is exactly what I speak about in detail in my book, what's happening. That we have allowed liberal thinkers to come up with things like replacement theology, and theology of liberation, where the miraculous in the Bible are not miraculous anymore. And almost the Bible becomes a revolutionary book. Where Yasser Arafat says Jesus was a Palestinian revolutionist, and Hanan Ashrawi says Jesus was a Palestinian revolution. All of a sudden, the greatest of the greatest is Palestinian. And they're the original Canaanites, they are the original Philistines. Well, there's a problem with that. How could the Palestinians be the original Philistines? The Canaanites were of a Hamitic origin. How could the Palestinians who claim to be Arab be of a Hamitic origin at the same rate, say they're Semitic? Yet this is being taught all throughout the schools. Exactly as what happened in Nazi Germany is happening again. It's very simple for your listeners to understand what's happening. Just look at Nazi Germany. Look at Nazi Germany, except this is a little different. This has a religious twist to it. So it's very hard to expose it, because once you do, guess what? You're labeled as anti-Muslim. You're labeled as anti-religion. You're labeled as evil. You're labeled as racist. So it's very hard to deal with a religion that has Nazism blended right with it.
Well, I agree with you totally, and I think it's just so vitally important that people begin to understand the true nature of the battle we're involved with. And however we look at what's happened as far as 9/11 is concerned, what I think we cannot ignore is the fact that there really is a growing animosity and hatred towards the United States within the Muslim world. And we're talking about at least 1.2 billion people. Many of them are being programmed through television, through the Emmons, through our good friends in Saudi Arabia. And the question is, why would we be allowing the Saudi Arabia to continue funding this world terrorist movement? Even the Council on Foreign Relations recently came out with a report, and I'm talking within the last 3 months, pointing out that the Bush administration has done nothing to stop Saudi Arabia from financing the world terrorist movement. Now, why are these things going on? Is there a master plan, or does God have a master plan? And perhaps certainly people within our society, within our government, are being led to do things which are illogical because of God's plan.
Well, I believe the Bible is correct. The Bible stated, regardless of whether the liberals don't like it or not, or the atheists don't like it or not, what we have is a religious war. This world is going to culminate in a religious war, just like the Bible predicted. And I believe if we dig Alaska, then we can fight Saudi Arabia more openly. But since the oil is a pressure, it's a delicacy, if you will, that we have got ourselves so used to that we have to kowtow for the Saudi government. And with the oil, with the power of oil, there was also the silencing of the world. You know, all the kings of the earth are committing harlotry with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has funneled all the educational systems throughout the Middle East and the Muslim world, making them Islamist. Saudi Arabia is the head of the snake, and there is not a single leader in the world today that's able to call a spade when it comes to Saudi Arabia, for two reasons. One of them is the oil, and the other one is that this is a religion that you're fighting. And people hesitate, leaders and politicians hesitate in calling a spade. I can guarantee you George Bush knows the facts, you know. He just has a hard time getting elected if he's going to be honest totally and calling this state a spade, to calling it what it is. This is unfortunate, you know. But I think eventually knowledge will increase, and people's knowledge will increase, and God will preserve certain nations that will stand with the truth. And I believe America will be one of them. Because if you look at Micah 5, it talks about the Messiah being born in Bethlehem. But it also talks about God raising 7 shepherds and 8 principled men. And they will decimate the land of Assyria and the Antichrist. So it's very clear that not all the nations will stand with the evil one. So this is where I disagree with some of the interpretation. Predominantly, I agree with most of the interpretations out there. But there's an area when it comes to Islam, as I studied the Bible, that that I happen to disagree with some of the interpretations. And I say Islam is the one. Why? Well, who doesn't honor the desire of women? It says he does not honor the desire of women. He does not honor any god, but he honors the god of fortress, which is the god of war. Who honors the god of war? Who is attempting to change times and laws, literal calendar system, and literal laws? Who is introducing Sharia law, trying to force it into the world? This is exactly what's happening, as the scripture has been telling us. But we're looking other places, trying to find out the interpretations, and we're looking to the West, when what's happening in the West is simply the falling away that the text of scripture taught us. What's happening in the East, in the Middle East? What do you do with countries like North Africa, Libya, Tunisia, Mauritania, you know, five Arab states there, which is considered Western Roman Empire. These are Western Roman Empire. If you want to revive a Roman Empire, you have to include these countries. These are all becoming fundamentalist Muslim countries as well. So the revival of the Roman Empire must encompass a huge armada of Muslim war machines. You can't deny it. It's in the text. Where it, you know, if you follow the text, it says the revived Roman Empire. Well, you have to, you know, add it up. And the Eastern Roman Empire was in Turkey. You know, what are you going to do with the Eastern Roman Empire, with Constantinople, with all these countries? Even Christ himself said, Pergamus, thou art the seat of Satan. Pergamus is in Turkey. So we can't ignore all these hints that are in Scripture pertaining to the Muslim world. In fact, I give a four-hour seminar just to talk about Islam in the Bible. 4-hour seminar. And prior to the seminar, I ask people about their views. When I finish the seminar, I ask if anybody is not convinced. I rarely have a hand that's lifted, because I comb through the entire text.
Well, now, Chris, one of the questions that many different interpretations of the scriptures, many, of course, Bible studies, and certainly Hal Lindsey, had always said, well, of course, the army of 200 million is going to come from China. But that could just as easily be coming from Islam, couldn't it?
From Iran all the way to Indonesia, Afghanistan, you could easily have 200 million men army.
Yeah, and of course, the other thing is that there's a great difference in interpretation of the significance of the war that we find described in Ezekiel 38 and 39, right, and the Battle of Armageddon. Do you think it's the same battle, or do you think they're two different incidents?
Look, it's the same battle for several reasons. Let me give you just one of them. It says there, regarding this person Gog, G-O-G, it says, are you the one whom the prophets of Israel foretold long ago? The prophets, plural. So you must ask yourself, what prophets predicted about Gog? If it's only in Ezekiel, it says prophets. So what did Joel say about Gog? It talks about the northern army in Joel. What did Isaiah say about Gog? What did Jeremiah say about Gog? It's the same person. And if you look at the earthquake and the fish of the sea and everything will shake at my presence. In fact, you will see a verse in Ezekiel 38 and 39 that says the God in Israel, God will be in Israel, not the God of Israel, God in Israel. It is phenomenal. And if you look at the nations, just look at the contemporaries of Ezekiel. Meshech and Tubal in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is the areas of the Caspian and the Black Sea. In fact, even Halanzi wouldn't deny that the Meshech and Tubal was in southern Russia. So you have this whole collection of information of these nations. In the North Quarters, it even says, in the North Quarters, you look at the North Quarters there, and you see exactly the formation of Gog and Magog. The Russian people are Scandinavians. They're not from the same stock as Gomer and Meshech and Tubal. Meshech and Tubal are the Turkic nations, and in fact, they're joining together. So we need to re-look and re-study prophecy again. In fact, I was looking at Hal Lindsey's book. He's a great guy. I love the man. His first book, The Great Planet Earth. And I remember he's had the Arab-Israeli War, and I was laughing. I was giggling because I said, well, Hal doesn't understand. It's really not the Arab-Israeli War. It's the Israeli-Arab-Islamic War. It's much bigger than just Arab countries. Pakistan and Afghanistan and Indonesia, they're not Arabic. They're Muslim. So, in fact, the second edition that came out, I looked at it, it says, oh, the Arab-Islamic War. So he got it. So knowledge will increase as we move further. I came out of this system, sort of like Captain Spock, you know. I can tell you what the aliens think. I can tell you what the aliens plan. Captain Kirk can't. You know, he's not been an alien. So it is a must that I send out the message of what really I believe the text is really saying. And we need to adjust a little bit. It's not that big of an adjustment, but nevertheless, it's an adjustment.
And I think it's so vitally important that you're out there and getting the information out. Well, somebody has asked what the name of your book is, and when would you think it'll be available?
It will be available in hopefully a month or so.
All right. Well, we'll be in touch in the meantime. And, of course, we'll certainly want to get you an opportunity to get that out through our ministry, because I think that it's so vitally important that the average American really comes to understand the true nature of the Islamic forces that are there that are lined against us, and there's just no way that this is going to be changed. They really do want to destroy America, don't they?
That's right. The true nature of the beast.
Now, what about what's going on here within our own Islamic schools? We have certainly a lot of young people going to Islamic schools, going to the mosques. Are many of the mosques in this country teaching the violence form of the religion?
They will teach the method and the system of their funders. When I was living in Garden Grove, California, I remember, they bought a whole block, a city block in Garden Grove. And I asked the imam there, I said, where did you get this money to buy this whole block? He says, well, we got it from Saudi Arabia. So if Saudi Arabia is funding it, they're not going to pay you unless you preach their doctrine. There is no funds coming for the secular Muslims. Where are they coming from? You know, so the funding and the money and the mechanism is coming from the Wahhabis. You have to understand, people say, well, only the Muslim world has only 15% fundamentalists. Well, if this is true, even if it is true, we're not winning fundamentalists to turn into becoming secular nice Muslims. It's vice versa. Non-fundamentalist Muslims are turning by the droves to becoming fundamentalist fanatics. It doesn't reverse, you see. So if this cancer keeps growing, in no time you will have a huge amount of Muslim fundamentalists.
And I really think that's happening not only in the Muslim countries, but certainly throughout Europe as well, and in England and right here in the United States. And
okay.
I'll never forget one time on the 60 Minutes, they had four Muslim girls, you know, dressed up, their heads completely covered, and they were sweet-looking girls. And yet, of course, they were espousing the cause of jihad. And one of them said, you know, if I walked into a naval base and blew myself up, I would go immediately to heaven. And she almost looked so happy. And of course, then, because this was on film, she apparently had called CBS a couple of days later and said, well, I was talking if I went into a naval base in Israel. But of course, she wasn't talking about a naval base in Israel. They're being programmed to aid America. And we can't allow that. Of course, you can't stop this, you know, by force. We have to, of course, counter it with Christianity and pointing out what's wrong with this religion. And I think that's really what's so vitally important about what you do.
That's right. But we have to also protect our borders. We have to stop the migration of Muslims to this country. It used to be a long time ago that people used to ask you in the embassy, when you become a citizen or you want to go to America, are you a communist? Do you belong to the Communist Party? Well, nobody's asking that question anymore, but we should ask the question, are you an Islamist? Do you belong to an Islamist party? And if you have a proof that you do, you cannot become a citizen of this country. You know, we should minimize the student visas for students who come from countries that are threatening to the United States. We need to tighten our borders and tighten our laws as well.
I agree with you totally. Well, our guest this evening has been Waleed Shubat, and you can find his website at www.shubat.com/HOEBAT, like shoe and like bat. Would that be right?
That's right. One word put together, .com.
And apparently there are a lot of good things there that you want to get. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners before we let you go?
Yes. Let's talk on the positive side. That, you know, even though this information I'm given is kind of troubling, that we need to understand and know 100% that we are in the victorious side. We are in the winning fight. We're not on the losing side. So we need to lift our heads up and know that we are on the right track. Yet when the world, when we see the world and what's happening, and we see that we're being persecuted, we're being demeaned, the end result, we're going to be laughing our way to the kingdom. You know, you laugh your way to the bank. We're going to be smiling towards the kingdom. And we're all going to be joining there together in Jerusalem. We're only renting here. So look up and keep your hopes up.
God bless you. Thank you so very much, and I'll be talking to you again, and we'll get you on to all of our other programs. I want your message heard across America. God bless you.
Bless you to you as well, brother.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our program this evening with Walid the Shubat, and let me just mention that we have a couple of things I think are so vitally important that people read, get the information, and help us get it out. First of all, we have a video, and if you haven't seen it, it's called The New Barbarians. It's the film footage that's being shown on Arab television across the world in Islamic countries. It's called The New Barbarians, put up at Carol Matriciana, and it's must-seeing to understand what's going on. Then we actually carry a four-tape set called Islam, the Religion of Doom. That's Islam, the Religion of Doom. We have a wonderful book by Craig Wynn. Now, it's almost 1,000 pages. And it's a big, heavy book, but it's got the information in it. The last two pages, however, last 200 pages, is simply they'll take the word Satanism, and they'll give you all the references, not only in the Quran, but in the Hadith and the Shira, and there are about four different basic writings. And so you can actually go there, and you can find all the references to Satanism, because, of course, they talked about Satan possessing Muhammad. He talked about it himself, about demons possessing Muhammad. And you need to have this information at your fingertips when you're discussing these issues. So we suggest that this book, pardon me, this four-tape set, the video, the book, The Prophet of Doom, the four-tape set, Islam, the Religion of Doom, and actually it's 4 hours of interviews with Craig Wynn, who wrote the book, The Prophet of Doom, and then, of course, the video, The New Barbarians. And I will tell you, this is one of the most gripping videos we have. Then, of course, we carry a book called The Islamic Invasion by Robert Morey. We have Is Fanatic Islam a Global Threat by Victor Mordecai. In fact, we have three books that Victor has written, and we recommend them all to you. But one of the most significant videos that you can get is Jihad in America. And it was produced for PBS in 1994. And it was actively suppressed, I believe, by the intelligence agencies because they didn't want you to know what was going on. They had a long-range plan, and we've actually created a monster. They suppressed the information that they've been studying the Islamic radical movement here in America. They knew they were planning to attack, but they did not want the American people to know. And they wanted to make you think that the OR are... intelligence agencies are just so disorganized, they don't know what's going on, it's all the process, and one group can't talk to another. You see this video, you realize they were right on top of it, and in 1994 the decision was made. We don't want the American people to know what's coming down the line, and we've created the best enemy money could buy, but that doesn't matter. It is still an enemy that threatens to destroy the very essence of this country, and we have created and financed in many respects this radical Islamic movement. If you doubt that, you need to get the article. The ABCs of Globalism will be glad to send you a free copy telling how we finance these radical schools throughout the Islamic world with $51 million of your tax money. That's the ABCs of Globalism. It's a free article we'll be glad to send you out of the Washington Post. We'll be glad to send you a free newsletter. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then remember, we're involved in a spiritual battle, being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, and now, of course, on the sands of Saudi Arabia. The sands of Iraq. Pray for America and pray for liberty till tomorrow. May the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here again. I'm coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have this on the line, certainly one of my favorite guests, and I'm sure yours as well, Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Hi, Joel.
Hello, Dr. Stan. Nice to be with you tonight.
Well, it's good. Always good to have you here, and there's so many exciting things that are going on. So what are the things we're going to address this evening?
Well, the major issue in last Friday's World Affairs Brief was the terror alert agenda. You know, increasingly Americans are becoming more skeptical of the Justice Department's terror alerts, besides the fact that virtually none, Dr. Stan, have ever come true in the past 3 years. I think the public's tiring of being told there's an increase in chatter or no specific evidence of a terrorist threat. These kinds of nebulous claims hardly lend to the government's credibility. So, you know, this past week, Homeland Security and the Department of Justice took a different tack. For the first time, they started revealing supposedly concrete evidence to justify the warnings that the mythical Al-Qaeda was targeting specific targets in the financial districts of New York and Washington. But the more the government tells us about this supposed evidence, it seems that the more they're using, to justify these increased alerts, the more obvious it becomes to careful observers that someone's manipulating the process of intelligence for political purposes. It appears that there is an agenda within the Bush administration and Justice Department to justify ever-increasing terror alerts, and the evidence for these alerts, flimsy it is, seems to emanate from very questionable sources linked to foreign intelligence agencies that have long had dealings with the CIA. In other words, it appears as if our own government is manufacturing these claims by, suddenly outing some particular agent who we find out after, Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, the supposed mastermind of 9/11, who's worked with CIA and ISI in Pakistan for years. And now we find the same specific source out of the sting operation in Pakistan that came through with these sudden discoveries that someone in Al-Qaeda had been surveilling five major financial district offices like the New York Stock Exchange. And I'm going to try to take apart for you, your listening audience, these claims to show you how, let me put it this way. You know, the government didn't really want to reveal anything good, so they revealed stale evidence, and then they tried to justify the stale evidence as if some terrorist attack could occur based upon stale evidence. And I want to try to explain how that simply is not true. How do you justify an orange alert on buildings that were surveilled 3 to 7 years ago? Well, the first thing that happened when media pundits start to criticize this is White House spokesman Scott McClellan is trotted out with the old excuse that Al-Qaeda plans these attacks years in advance. Well, maybe so, but that still doesn't explain how credible intelligent people would just laugh at the fact that someone was planning a surveillance or basing an attack 3 to 5 years down the road on surveillance that's 3 to 7 years old. You know, what evidence is there that these surveillance operations were even connected to Al-Qaeda? This is a convenient tag, of course, that the government puts on any suspect so as to give them credibility as a link to terror. But, you know, when you ask the media, well, who said there was a link to Al-Qaeda? Well, the CIA or the FBI or Homeland Security said there was a link to Al-Qaeda, but they never tell them what that was. And secondly, what evidence is there to support the claim that the attack is now imminent when the intelligence is so stale? As anyone with military training knows, stale intelligence cannot be used as the sole basis for mounting a successful attack. Everything's changed since 9/11. Al-Qaeda would have to do all of its surveillance all over again to assure that security measures in these buildings are the same, which they're not. Anyone with half a brain would know that all the security things around any of these buildings has changed, even in the past 6 months. So there's virtually no relationship between surveillance that occurred 3 to 7 years ago and an attack that's supposedly in the offing for this year. It just cannot be related by any credible stretch of the imagination.
Well, I certainly would tend to agree with that. I was very disturbed. In fact, there was even an article in the New York Times, of all places, saying an awful lot of people are beginning to question whether we're just being scared to death with it. This is sort of a wag-the-dog scenario to get us all upset as we move towards the November election.
Well, it's interesting that as soon as the criticism of the stale evidence came out, you know, in the absence of any normal evidence of terror, Tom Ridge immediately came out, Director of Homeland Security, and claimed that there was another stream of new evidence that, coupled with the old, justified the high alert status. Naturally, we're expected to take his word for it, because he virtually would give no specifics about what this other stream of new evidence was. And you know, the greatest danger, as Randall Yim, head of Government Accounting Office, Homeland Security Division, said, the greatest danger is that all of these increased terror alerts blunts the public's confidence. If you have a lot of crying wolf all the time, or worse, you tell people to be more vigilant, but you don't give them any additional steps to take to be more vigilant.
Well, what they did was apparently they slowed down the traffic, you know, in the areas in New York City, and, you know, bridge traffic and everything was being checked. And, you know, they do this for 3 or 4 days, and then they say, well, now we've thwarted the attack, and now you can go back to your regular ways. Well, how do you know you've thwarted the attack, you know? Why would you possibly think you've thwarted the attack because you slowed down traffic and tied up your things in New York City and New Jersey and a couple of other cities for a couple of days? It just doesn't make any sense. Unless maybe they're trying to convince us that what they're saying is true, and it's all a matter of perception rather than reality.
Well, the biggest thing I think that's happening, and by the way, as I pointed out after 9/11, the biggest effect of 9/11 was not the terrorist attack itself. It was the government reaction to the terrorist attack, shutting down the airline system. Really put a big hole in the economy, and this continues to be the largest financial impact of any terrorist attack is the government overreaction. You know, shutting down whole regions, invoking whole new inspection routines. It just simply it doesn't do anything to really effectively stop terrorism. All government is doing is appearing to do something because the public expects something to be done. What the public doesn't realize is that the larger agenda is, I believe, that you put out enough increased terrorist alerts that you get people very, very accustomed to having increased police presence everywhere. And you get them accustomed to having their lives intervened at will by the government without question. And I think this not only has a huge economic impact on the country, which it cannot sustain if they keep it up, but over time it does get people used to complying with government edicts, such as, frankly, what happened in Germany when you started to, when he took away democratic powers, Hitler declared himself, you know, the Führer for life, and in essence, Parliament was disbanded and it became a dictatorship, and people became accustomed to taking orders, and it was out of a war mentality. The bombing of the Reichstag and other indications that we had to, you know, they had to pool Germanic power and to fight this great communist aggression. So I think this is something that has been used historically. I think we have to be very skeptical in the United States about the growing police state. We're just being accustomed to seeing camouflaged uniforms, guns, dogs, and standing guards everywhere. It's what's happened in Israel, and they've gotten used to it. I think there's a great deal that is being taken advantage of in terms of flag-waving Americans willing to surrender many of their rights because of terrorism. I can't remember which of the commentators it was on the radio the other day who was challenging his readers to name one thing that the Patriot Act did to take away individual liberties, and immediately got flooded with calls with lots of evidence that it took away liberties and had to shut down the conversation.
And I really think that this is what they do. They say, you know, just give me one example. You try to give them an example, and they shut you off. This happened at a major debate in front of some very, very prominent people when I challenged a member of PNAC, on the Patriot Act, and simply said to him, well, where in the Patriot Act does it mention Islamic terrorism? What you've done is changed the definition of terrorism, so anybody who disagrees with the government is a terrorist. Well, he attacked me as being pro-Islamic, pro Osama bin Laden, a pro-terrorist, you know, how dare you say that? And then, of course, he said, why, you can't show me one time where this has ever been used, you know, without justification, or it's ever been used for anything other than to intercede against terrorism, and then they wouldn't give me any opportunity to respond. So, but this is the technique that they're using increasingly, is to demonize anybody who points out that the Patriot Act has very little to do with Islamic terrorism. There may be a few things there that made it easier for them to hold people at least temporarily, but also they can hold not only Islamic terrorists, but anybody else that they deem wants to change our form of government. Well, the first thing they ought to do is arrest everybody in the Council on Foreign Relations because they want to change our form of government. But I bet they're not going to do that because they'd be arresting a large part of the current cabinet of the United States.
That's right. Well, in another story, someone had the courage, specifically Capitol Hill Blue out of the Washington, D.C. area, to talk about George Bush under powerful antidepressant drugs, trying to control his erratic behavior, his depression, and paranoia. This basically revelations that come secondhand through Colonel Richard J. Tubb, the White House physician. And because of this leak, Capitol Hill Blue did talk to several White House people who spoke off the or on condition of anonymity. One aide to the president said, you know, these drugs are a double-edged sword. We can't have him flying off at the handle of the slightest provocation, but we also need a president who is alert mentally, and these antidepressant drugs, you know, have a problem with altering moods. But what really set them off the other day is a story that was reported on, at least in the Internet. The mainstream media didn't keep it or carry it very much, but reporters were badgering the president in one of his news conferences on July 8th, about his relationship with indicted Enron executive Kenneth Lay. And he literally stormed off the stage. I don't know if you ever saw any of that on television.
No, I didn't.
He just lost his cool, couldn't handle it, stormed off the stage, and we now know what he said as soon as he saw his first aide as he got off the stage. He said, keep those blankety-blank MFers away from me. He screamed, he says, if you can't, I'll find someone who can. Now, this actually, and I'm going to take a different opinion than Capitol Hill Blue, in my opinion, this doesn't represent erratic, schizophrenic, depression, or paranoia. I believe what we just saw in that quote is the real President Bush. You know, people who have a foul mouth, as the president has from various different sources, and this is anyone who uses the F word regularly is a foul-mouthed individual. And this is very much at juxtaposition to anyone professing, in my opinion, to be born again in their commitment to Christ. You know, conscience speaks against using that kind of foul-mouthed language, and the president uses it all the time. Bill Clinton used it all the time. All of the presidents, except Ronald Reagan, used it very regularly, and it tells you something about them. I mean, these people are used to being pampered. What this remark to his aide about keep those MFers away from me was a knowledge by the president that his handlers have the power to control the media. And this was obviously a couple of reporters that were out of control. What the president mean is you're going to have to get with those people and clamp down and make sure they never show up in front of one of my news conferences again.
And of course what they do is they simply exclude them from the news conferences. Their name isn't on the list and they don't get in, and that may very well mean the end of their job.
Yes, and of course that's why the aides often go to a scripted news conference where he looks down and he has a list of names of which reporters to talk about to call upon, and those reporters have canned questions that have been pre-approved by the White House. So, I'm I'm not for using these antidepressant drugs, for people I don't like, mood-altering drugs, in general for normal people whose habit patterns can be controlled through self-control and conscience. Bush is an admitted alcoholic, and though he's never sought treatment in a formal program, and stories about his cocaine use as a young man, still are floating around. This kind of behavior is fair lack of self-control, flying off the handle, typical of people who have had a history of lack of self-control in other areas, like whether it's obesity, or alcoholism, or cocaine use. This is actually a very normal pattern for people who are in a deteriorating spiritual sense, where they're losing emotional control, and eventually their handlers really have a problem with them.
Well, you do think that this story about his taking antidepressants is really true. Certainly I saw the article on the Internet. Do we have any other verification for this? Has anybody checked with the
physician? No, but there's enough quotes, direct quotes from AIDS and other things that clearly this reporter was talking to people and getting tacit confirmation. So I'm convinced that it's correct. But what I'm trying to say is, the real story isn't that he's taking antidepressants. The real story is the president's got a chronic bad mouth. The president's got a chronic bad temper. He's been pampered all of his life. He's been bailed out from one situation. And when he gets into a situation where he gets strangled or where he gets caught off guard, embarrassed, he flies off the handle. He has a tantrum. So I don't care if you throw antidepressants at it. The problem is with the president.
It's really a spiritual problem.
That's correct.
I'll tell you that once you really are a born-again Christian, you can't speak like that, or at least you won't do it very often. Because you know it's wrong, and God will intervene. Your life really changes when you do become a Christian.
That's right. And there is no indication that President Bush is... other than paying lip service to his born-again experience to the television cameras, which was a great propaganda coup that welded all of the Christians to this president. There is no indication from all the people that I know as insiders of the White House that Bush is anything other than his normal womanizing, reading and pornography, foul-mouthed conversation, except when he gets around people who are of the Christian thing, who come to visit him in the office, then he puts on a face and he's really acting in front of them, but his real person is how he is with his AIDS.
Well, I've, of course, heard rumors about this for some time. We even have a couple of articles on it from liberal magazines, but there was a recent mention in the conservative U.S. News and World Report, and if our listeners would like to get a copy of that, simply a full-page article, about the foul mouth and the use of the vulgar words repeatedly in the Oval Office. And if any of you out there are skeptical, this is not from the Kerry camp at all. This is from the people who ordinarily would expect would be supporting the president. But I am deeply disturbed that the Christian community may be being used and manipulated in this whole thing, and especially since I was part of the original Christian group that selected George Bush to be the president, and of course there were only two of us who didn't go along with all the rest of the Christian leaders, and they swung the entire power of the conservative Christian movement behind George Bush. And I think, as I said, I was only two of us who were at that meeting did not go along. The rest of the Christian leaders did, and I think the Christian leaders bear a responsibility for what has befallen our nation. So we'll be back here in just a few moments with our special guest Joel Skousen, and of course we'll ask you to hold your calls until after the half hour, because I want Joel to be able to develop these ideas before we begin to get questions and answers. So in just a moment, we're going to have to go to break, and then we'll be back here after about a 4-minute break, and we'll be going on with more of this incredible story. But I believe America is in real trouble, because I believe America has turned its back on the foundation from which all freedom comes, and that is the idea that our freedoms come from God. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Pick the story up there, Joel.
Well, I'd like to switch topics and, to a certain extent, and talk about an National Security Advisor Samuel Berger getting off the hook. I predicted that the week prior that he would not be prosecuted, and sure enough, the reasoning the government has given for not prosecuting is novel, if not absurd. Berger's being let off the hook because, quote, no original materials were missing from the archives, only copies. Now, since when is it as a lesser offense to be in possession of classified material that's a copy instead of the original? In point of fact, the archival personnel, in setting their trap for Berger, gave him copies rather than the originals, knowing that he'd stolen other copies on a prior visit. And it's a crime to take anything out of the National Archives without permission, even copies, not to mention originals. Once again, the protection racket that I've talked about before, run by the dark side of government, is still healthy and efficient for all fellow insiders. And Sam Berger is clearly an insider.
And I think that, of course, this is the way the system works. I mean, here, Dick Cheney's still getting a salary from Halliburton, and Halliburton's getting sweetheart deals with the government for literally billions of dollars, and then we find that they're cheating, and Cheney is getting a salary. I don't understand why there isn't an outcry from the media.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Cliff Kincaid of Accuracy of Media did comment on why the media has taken it so easy on Berger. He quote, and I quote him, he says, now we know why the press has played down the revelations about Clinton National Security Advisor Sandy Berger removing highly classified documents from the National Archives. John Harris of the Washington Post reports that Berger was well liked by the White House and foreign policy reporters. This was clearly demonstrated, says Kincaid, when the Berger scandal broke. The Post did not play the story on page one. It went on to page two in the New York Times, put it on the bottom of page 16. And then they use such words as removing rather than steal or theft. Harris, in fact, claimed that Berger left the archive buildings with copies of documents that were supposed to remain there. You know, this is that's about as kindly as you can put it, supposed to remain there. It's a curious formulation, says Cliff Kincaid. Did they just stick to his clothes? Were they like Post-it notes that he sat on? Berger says it was inadvertent or accidental. Well, I don't know how you inadvertently get something inside your pants.
I heard you stuffing them in his socks.
Yeah, in your socks. He also put some inside his pants.
You know, it's amazing, Joel. How gullible do they think the American people are? Where is the outrage? Where is the double standard? I mean, look at what they did to Martha Stewart, and
yes,
then look what they did to Samuel Berger.
Well, you know, in point of fact, if they had made an outrageous case about Sandy Berger, like they did about Martha Stewart, the public would have got upset. Even so, you know, Martha Stewart had a tremendous amount of backing from people who thought she got a raw deal, and I think they really did take advantage of I think they wanted, and I don't understand why they wanted to persecute her because of her celebrity status. I mean, she's been pretty much a liberal most of her life. She's no arch conservative that has attacked either Clinton or the Bush administration. So it's hard to say why they tried to attack her, other than maybe she was a sacrificial lamb so that they could say that, look, we're getting the big one of the big fat cats. We're not being, so that when they let other fat cats off, like Sandy Berger, they could get away with it.
Okay, well, you hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our stations back from across America right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and I'm going to ask you to hold your calls until after the half hour, because we want, of course, to get Joel develop the ideas. So is there anything else we want to talk about poor old Sandy Berger? And my goodness, maybe he had holes in his socks. That's why he had to stuff those things in there.
I think I'd like to cover a little bit about the economy now.
Okay, fine. Well, I think that is such an important issue.
Well, we have some really real aspects of the economy that appear schizophrenic. In other words, dual personality. Major sectors of the economy are really hurting, and other sectors are literally awash with money. So whether or not your listeners are feeling like they're in the midst of a bust or a boom really depends on where they stand financially relative to the flood. I mean, literal flood of federal deficit spending is pouring into the economy. If you're downstream of the billions being poured into the military-industrial complex, or Halliburton, or anyone else, you're experiencing a boom. And the effect of these high-level spending is really spreading out into the investment and construction sectors of the economy, leading to literally double-digit inflation in these sectors. Those who are having to buy building materials at inflated prices, for example, are really taking a hit. Those that are out to buy business or investment property at reasonable prices are finding that prices are just skyrocketing for sound investments. The market is flooded with high rollers anxious to park their millions anywhere they can keep up with inflation. So it's interesting that we have a highly selective inflation in certain consumer and construction markets. Now, coupling this with higher gas prices, this is really absorbing a significant portion of people's available spending cash, leaving much less available for discretionary spending. Thus, the overall consumer spending has dropped despite the inflation in certain sectors. Now, this is why U.S. economic growth in the spring quarter fell to 3%, and these are manipulated numbers, compared to 4.5% same last year. Now, there's also another factor that had to do with the summer quarter. Walmart, for example, had the highest profits in history during the summer quarter of last year, and that's because the special tax rebate hit the streets, and a lot of those people went down to cash them and spend them at Walmart. In fact, on I was listening to one of the Wall Street reports, and on the website and the telephone investment service for Walmart, they actually give that an explanation of why their profits were lesser this year than last year, is they didn't have access to these government rebate checks. So these things really did have a stimulatory effect on the economy last year. We don't have one of those this year, and frankly, the economy is really flat. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is well below 10,000. That's a psychological breakpoint that really worries the government. I think they're going to be interjecting a lot of cash. In fact, it was really funny or strange the way the Federal Reserve reacted to this week, Stan. With the weakness that the economy is showing, with a paltry 35,000 jobs created, whereas the last quarter there were some, 135,000, albeit low-quality jobs, there weren't any real high-quality professional jobs created. But nevertheless, with this weakness in the economy, really you would have expected the Fed to keep interest rates the same. But they almost had to raise interest rates, because there is an expectation of inflation and a commensurate expectation the Fed has to do something to start cooling that inflation, or at least inhibiting its upward movement. In fact, it is selective inflation. Some portions of the economy are not inflating. A lot of stocks are not going anywhere. The ones that are mostly manipulated with options and by government intervention, the index stocks, are the ones that have been high, went up to a second bubble, and it looks like they're starting a downward decline now. I'm still expecting the government to intervene in order to carry George Bush through the election. But still, this economy has some real weaknesses in it, and if these interest rates continue to climb, it will affect the real estate bubble, which is probably related to a third of economic growth. So we could see a topping out and busting of the real estate market here after the election sometime.
Well, I certainly agree with you. I think that certainly as far as the energy prices are concerned, natural gas, oil, as far as the price of food, all of these things are going up at a very, very good clip. And I believe that it's not simply the perception of inflation. I really think that there is inflation. I will tell you that you try to buy a house here in California, certainly in along the coast where I live, and the average house here is probably $600,000. The average house. I mean, how do you make enough money to afford something like that? So I believe you're absolutely right. I think we have a real estate bubble, and I think that bubble is about to pop. But I've been saying that for a long time. Going to be interesting to see what happens here in the next 6 months or so. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen, editor of World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. And, you know, I was looking at the Wall Street Journal today, and there was an article in there about Warren Buffett, who I think is a fascinating individual. And it's just pointing out that he is now has something like $19 billion, and whether they're in options or what they are, but $19 billion, he is betting the dollar is going to go down again. So, and he's been doing this for a couple of years. He's done very, very well. He's made a lot of money. He bought the dollar when the dollar was, when the euro was 8.87 cents, and now it's up to about $1.20. And, of course, he's made a lot of money, on the drop of the dollar. But now he's increasing in his investments into that, and I think that Warren Buffett knows what's going to happen. He's apparently fairly close to Lord Rothschild, and if Warren Buffett's voting against the dollar, I think we all ought to be concerned.
Well, I would only caution, though, that the dollar is so huge that it's very hard to affect the dollar. There's so many of them out there, even with the massive inflation that the Fed has been pouring into this for years, it still hasn't shown up as significant inflation in the United States because of the great pool of dollars there is out to absorb that. That great pool of dollars resists any fast and rapid falls or rises of the dollar. So I would only caution that I don't believe there will be anything precipitous. That's why, for example, Iraq or various other oil companies switching to euro-based things really didn't have a lot of effect. The effect that the euro people thought it would, because simply those countries, even though they're switching to the euro, still have billions of dollars in their accounts. They can't just try to liquidate them all immediately. They have to protect the fact that they do have those billions, and they don't want the value to go down, otherwise they can't liquidate them. So there's a tremendous amount of cross-competition between those who want to see the dollar go down and those that want to see it strengthened. And most of the European nations actually want to see it strengthened, as does Japan and China. And that's why they continue to support the dollar.
And that's so they can sell their products here.
That's right. So there is a great deal of interlinking that keeps any suicide mentality from really taking hold. But I think my point should be remembered that the pool of dollars is so big relative to other currencies, nothing's going to change the relative value of that pool in a precipitous manner.
What about in a gradual manner?
Oh, yes, very definitely.
All right, well, we're going to have to be bringing our other seasons back with us in just a moment. And, of course, if you're out there and then you'd like to give us a call, our number 1-800-888-3... Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Joel Skousen. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But if you're out there, if you would, first of all, I want to get Joel's address out there. So if you'd like to get hold of the World Affairs Brief, while you can, how can people reach you and get the sample copies of your publication?
There's two different ways. If you have access to the web, you want to go to www.worldaffairsbrief.com. That's written as one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. And on there you find all the daily postings from my researchers. They're really good about scouring the web for the news stories, the important ones. These are the ones that I will be analyzing at the end of each week. My World Affairs Brief comes out on Friday. And you can read excerpts and samples of past editions of the World Affairs Brief by going to the archives. The World Affairs Brief is by subscription. It's a very modest price for weekly issues every single week. I never take a vacation for that. So you can also read an awful lot of past investigative reporting I did about various government cover-ups. Just a lot on worldaffairsbrief.com for people to enjoy.
And there's really a tremendous amount of information, and you know, maybe a 6 or 8 new articles every day. Fascinating. So that's worldaffairsbrief.com. Now, what happens if they want to, of course, to subscribe? They would go to your website.
Right. They can just click on the subscribe button. It takes them right to a PayPal menu where they can use a credit card, or if they're a PayPal member, they can pay that way. There's also instructions. They can always send me an old-fashioned check as well. for those that now don't have access to the web, there's a toll-free number that they can call to get the current sample of the World Affairs Brief in printed edition. And that is 877, part of the Genesis Communication Network that we're on periodically, Dr. Stan. But it's 877-518-5888. And just tell them that you heard about Joel Skousen's World Affairs Brief on Stan Monteith and would like a sample copy. That's 877-518-5888.
All right, fine, and I recommend it to you. I read it when it comes in every week, and it's one of the two things I read on a regular basis. There's so much out there, but great, great information. So what are some of the other issues you'd like to talk about?
Well, in the news, there's been a lot about the ongoing investigation on Abu Ghraib jail. Apparently, Brigadier General Janusz Karpinski, the one who was set up as the scapegoat by the Pentagon, told British Broadcasting Corporation that she had information suggesting that officials took action to specifically keep her in the dark about the mistreatment. There's a reliable witness, she said, who made a statement indicating that not only was I not included in any of the meetings discussing interrogation operations, but specific measures were taken to ensure I did not have access to those facilities, that information or details of the interrogations did not come across my desk. Now, obviously she refused to identify the witness, but more importantly, when she was directly asked if she thought there was a conspiracy at a senior level to keep her out of the loop, she responds, yes, correct, that's what I understood. It was people that had full knowledge of what was going on out at Abu Ghraib who knew that they had to keep Janusz Karpinski from discovering any of those activities. Now, she refused to name whether the conspiracy reached up to the Pentagon or the White House, but obviously it does. As I pointed out, there's lots of evidence for that. However, I want to say, though, that I'm not letting her off the hook that easy. If she were really doing her job, she would have made a much more concerted effort to put in place her own informants to let her know what was going on. I mean, nobody is in charge of any prison system who doesn't know that corruption is endemic to prison systems. And you can't be a warden of a prison unless you set up your own spy system so that you find out what the guards are doing behind your back. And that's just dereliction of duty on her part, to have sat at her desk and allowed this kind of stuff to go on, without her knowledge.
All right, well, we've got Roger calling in here from Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. You have a question?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to tell the folks that right now you're currently being broadcast on a second worldwide frequency, so I want to refer folks back to your standard frequency of 7.315 megahertz and make sure they don't miss your first earlier 2 hours of the evening starting 6 p.m. Eastern on 9.430. And God bless you all.
All right, fine. Are we coming in on 7.5352?
Yep, your old frequency, too.
Okay, well, that's we've got good coverage. We just need people listening. Thanks so very much.
God bless.
Bye-bye. Well, you know, one of the interesting things about the investigation of what happened at Abu Ghraib prison is the fact that England, woman who we've seen in the pose there with the leash around the prisoner's neck and all sorts of vulgar activities, initially had said that she was ordered to do what she did, and none of this is being brought out at the trial. Do you think that they were not ordered to do it? This was simply a cover. Have they been told, if you keep your mouth shut, you're not going to spend 35 years in prison? What's really going on? Do you have any idea?
Oh, yes. Clearly, there's enough evidence now to show that they had more than just a tacit go-ahead. They were encouraged to do these types of things. Of course, the stripping of prisoners naked is a policy, an official policy that took place long before Abu Ghraib prison. All the Iraqi prisoners out in the desert, as soon as they were captured, were stripped naked and handcuffed in big circles and paraded before villagers to humiliate them. So there was a humiliation policy, and it doesn't take much imagination to let people go wild when they say, you can do anything you want, and then you have contests to see who can, do the most outrageous photograph. It isn't that there was an actual order from a general saying, you will go out and abuse these prisoners. It was more subtle than that, but it clearly came from higher-ups. I mean, people in the military at the lower level simply do not engage in this kind of conduct publicly and openly, and taking pictures of it, which is proof and evidence. I mean, they're not that stupid to make their own evidence against themselves, unless they know that there's tacit and semi-official approval, which there was.
And really, I think the most amazing thing, number one, is that they took pictures of what they were doing. Number two, that the government had these pictures, and then the government released these pictures. Now, if there was ever something I was going to be suppress, if I was in charge, you know, in wartime, I would justify keeping those pictures from being released, because I would not want, of course, to bring disgrace upon our military and really demoralize people and begin to lose confidence in my military. So the fact that those pictures were actually sent out all across the world, and the media throughout the world, was done with a very specific purpose in mind, and of course the question was, what was that purpose?
Well, as you and I both feel, we think that there's a concerted effort to antagonize certain core groups in the world against the United States so as to induce a huge eventual future backlash, and that backlash will cause trigger events that will bring Russia and China into a third world war scenario with the United States, and I think that's the real purpose. Oil is secondary. Antagonizing the world is the first and foremost purpose of all of this intervention.
And of course, I think the other interesting thing was that as a result of the embarrassment to the United States, why George Bush, who up to this point had said, we will not under any circumstances allow American soldiers to be put under the authority and can be tried by the International Criminal Court, suddenly reversed the position he had taken and held so strongly and said, all shucks, just because of what happened, we're going to have to let the International Criminal Court now be able to try American soldiers. And that, to me, is frightening.
Well, it is frightening because the higher-ups never get on the docket. Oh, if you're Slobodan Milosevic or if you're Saddam Hussein, you get to the docket, but we'll never see any Americans get there. American leaders get there. They will simply allow... And I'm not so sure how much they're going to allow in terms of prosecution of American troops. The reason I say that is because they do not want the Americans to build up any hostility towards moving into a judicial environment controlled by the United Nations. I think they want to keep that fairly positive, or at least keep the American public immune from the effects of that. So I'd be surprised. You know, they have an awful lot of power to persuade NATO allies who run a lot of these tribunals to do their bidding. It's awfully hard to tell the difference between what they're saying in public and what they're doing behind the scenes to keep things like that from happening.
Amen to that. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk to Joel Skousen, who is the editor of World Affairs Brief. Okay, Joel, are there any other issues that we should be talking about this evening?
A major issue that I put out last week was an analysis of Reverend Sun Myung-moon and his mysterious influence in the empire that he's built. As you know, Reverend Moon's in charge of the Korean-based Unification Church, who has at various times claimed to be the Earth's Messiah. He's long been considered a pariah in American politics, and yet, strangely, his influence keeps growing rather than diminishing. You know, it's all we can do in the conservative movement, the constitutional patriotic movement, to reach anyone but a small portion of the remnant, and yet someone who is as radical as bogus as claiming the Messiah grows in influence among establishment people who couldn't care anything about religion, essentially. You know, it's really strange. The lure apparently tends to be copious amounts of money the Reverend Moon has to offer. Not directly, of course, but through nice-sounding foundations and Moon-connected organizations such as, you know, those seeking world peace or other do-gooder causes which establishment types are prone to affiliate with. You know, one of the biggest coups that they pulled off was a symposium for Interreligious and International Federation of World Peace. They had another one on Women's Federation for World Peace, World Cultural and Sports Festival, Middle East Peace Initiative. All these groups are founded by or affiliated with Moon. They've lured lawmakers, congressional staffers, and many UN ambassadors to their symposiums. And it makes it very easy to send out invitations to U.S. congressmen when you can name that such ambassadors are going to be there, etc. Well, the most controversial meeting took place in, of all places, in the Dirksen Senate office building, arranged by none other than Senator Warner of Republican of Virginia. And apparently Moon was presented a crown of peace, a literal crown in the name of peace, an award was, and he obviously had awards for several other guests. Moon's group honored Senator Martin Dayton of Minnesota, Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania, Chris Cannon of Utah, Roscoe Bartlett of Maryland. You know, these people had to be pretty naive and stupid to even get caught accepting one of these awards, let alone, you know, mixing religion influence with the Senate use of Senate office buildings, which is something that if real live Christian organizations tried to do, they'd be shut down in a moment. In fact, Reverend Boone was decked out in a floor-length cape. He wore this gold crown, a Lifetime Achievement Award. He was introduced by a rabbi to a star-studded audience, claiming that a new era had become. Reverend Moon turned a few heads, I guess, by pointing out that while he was human as the next guy, in the context of heavenly providence, he said, "I am God's ambassador sent to earth with his full authority. I am sent to accomplish his command to save the world's 6 billion people and restoring them to heaven with the original goodness in which they were created." That's a pretty pompous statement to be made in front of establishment senators and congressmen. Well, this is only part of the story. The real question is, why is Moon able to make headway when any other crackpot religious preacher would have been, you know, hooted out of the Dirksen office building? Well, you know, Moon has claimed that his income came from selling religious trinkets in Japan. Part of this story is true. They obviously did sell trinkets there, but they cannot account for the multi-millions he's thrown into the purchase of the Washington Times, which was a wash in red ink. Moon has lavished money on various conservative organizations in order to gain influence, everyone from Falwell to Cleon Skousen and his constitutional seminars. And these organizations have always been hard up enough that they needed the money, and they took the money and, you know, tried to explain away their reservations about Moon. But it's my feeling that Moon really is fronting for the dark side of government.
I've always had that same feeling. You don't get that sort of money unless you're getting it from some other source.
That's right. You know, despite the outlays of millions each month to keep his empire, none of these foundations, think tanks, or the Washington Times makes money. I mean, Moon is just literally paying and paying millions of dollars every week to all of these. But with all those financial outlays and no seeming income other than trinkets from Japan, we find now his financial empire keeps growing. He's now into the acquisition of automobile factories in Korea, import-exports business, industrial salvage firms. I mean, this is like a mega-government in operation. Now, this would not be so much of a concern in and of itself, except for Moon's recent use of some of these shell corporations to give millions of dollars, I repeat, he gave a gift of several million dollars to communist North Korea just at the time that it needed to be bailed out in some foreign exchange problems. He also purchased a dozen salvaged Russian missile submarines, which got into North Korea's arsenal. The point that I'm trying to make here is that this is looking more and more like a government operation. There's no private corporation that gets to go and buy and sell and deal in Russian missile submarines, even though they've been dismantled. Obviously, going to North Korea with all the Russian advisors they have there, those could be rearmed and put back into operation. This appears to be a circuitous route in which Russia simply transferred through Moon Russian submarines, and Moon was well compensated for this. But in any case, $3 million birthday present to communist dictator Kim Jong-il was bad enough. The missile submarines are really worrying Japan now. And one may say, for example, that, well, maybe Moon is just fronting for the communists, and that's where his payment is. But I don't think so. Before jumping to the conclusion that Moon's a secret communist station, I think one must consider the evidence that the U.S. government itself has long played a role in propping up communist regimes, even while attacking them verbally. This fits their globalist purposes, whereby they need a future antagonist, so they build up communists to undermine free market governments and build up socialism, and then they replace them as they need them with globalists, as they did in with Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. So given Moon's mysterious and seeming unlimited funding sources, my analysis leads me to believe that Moon may be an agent working and funded by globalist interests which control our own government. Certainly his actions are in line with the long-term modus operandi of the globalists in controlling both sides of the political spectrum, and Moon is overtly trying to control the political right and keep it from ever mentioning the word conspiracy. That's the two noteworthy things I can note about the Washington Times and Insight magazine, is they never mention conspiracy.
You're absolutely right, and yet, of course, the Washington Times and Insight were the two finest sources of information that we have, perhaps in New America, other than, of course, the World Affairs Brief. And I think it's certainly not, and I've always thought that this was a CIA front working through South Korean intelligence. And, of course, many, many people have suggested that certainly he was tied to South Korean intelligence, but South Korean intelligence and the CIA pretty much are the same thing, aren't they?
Yes, there's a seamless relationship there as well. But it's interesting, you know, the Washington Times really got its start and endeared itself to the conservative movement during the Clinton administration when it attacked rightfully, said all the right things about the Clinton administration. But even as Bush has continued to rubber stamp and continue the Clinton policies, whether globally or specifically or having to do with security, the Washington Times has failed to criticize the Bush administration for that. It has been like a rubber stamp for this administration. So I think that there's a very real purpose in controlling the right-wing organizations and news publications, because if you can keep conservatives wedded to the Bush administration and keep them from having second thoughts about the loyalty of the Bush administration, you can continue this knee-jerk patriotism that has virtually eliminated any significant conservative criticism of this president.
I think it's a very, very good point. My concern is that almost every conservative organization I know has been infiltrated, and almost all of them are going along with the Bush administration. Well, right now, let's go to Dale, who's calling from San Jose. Hi, Dale.
Hi there. Yeah. Mr. Skelton, I would just like have a quick question about the Bush family. As I understand it, their connections with the Moons go back very deep and a long ways back. But even though that may be more obvious, I'd like to know if you're aware of any of their connections with the, let's say, the Democratic Party, if not Kerry himself. And I'll take your answer on the air.
Thank you. Do you know anything about the friendship between George Bush and John Kerry?
No, the friendship between the Bush family and
Kerry. And
Moon
as well.
And Reverend Moon, yes. The Reverend Moon allocated $10 million for President George Bush after he left office, with speaking fees and going to various ribbon-cutting ceremonies on Moon's behalf in South Korea. Nobody knows exactly how much of the $10 million Bush actually received, but that's an inflated amount for speaking fees. So the influence went way, way back. There has not been, in my opinion, an answer to his other question, the same kind of influence of Moon into liberal organizations. He seems to be targeting right-wing organizations to compromise them, to keep them from going into the embrace of the constitutional conservative libertarian side. He wants them to remain loyal to the establishment Republican side, and that seems to be the major purpose of the entire Moon infiltration into the conservative movement. His money is targeting and goes to people who will be amenable to saying yes to the Bush administration.
And I think the great tragedy is some of the finest Christian ministries we have, I think, have tainted themselves by taking, you know, the million or $2 million that the moon has offered them. And, you know, of course, right now I would love to get a couple of $1 million to help do what we do. And I could think of all sorts of justifications for doing it. I just hope Mr. Moon, Reverend Moon, never offers me any money because it would be a very difficult situation. And I would, of course, hope that I would have the moral integrity to say no thank you.
I'm sure you would, Dr. Stan, knowing that there's a trap, you know, behind things. The reason I don't think that we ever get the funding sources, despite, I think, the Lord's support for our cause, is that there is a major battle beyond what we're aware of, and to a certain extent, I think the forces of Satan have to be given significant powers in the last days to win the battle temporally as a major test for the remnant. So I'm not optimistic about winning back the country temporally. I know we must act as if we can win, but we most importantly must simply be content to influence those without who will accept the truth without compromise. I know there's a tremendous pressure to compromise in almost every one of the major ministries where we have seen this kind of compromise to the George Bush administration takes place, because anytime they criticize Bush, they lose major contributors to their organization. I know that Dobson has been affected by that. Our good friend Don McElvaney has gone very, not mainstreamish, but at least he's really hushed his criticism of Bush, because his marketing goes out to a great many middle-of-the-road conservatives who would stop subscribing if he were to criticize Bush.
Well, that's fortunately we're not so lost that we have to change our position, and we've lost some support, but I don't worry about it. I feel that I'm called to do what I'm doing, and I'm not dependent upon my ministry for my income. We do what we do because we feel that we're called to do it. Joe, we're out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listener before we let you go?
Well, only to say that we need to keep our faith in God, that even if we don't win temporarily, there is an escape for us, you know, if we follow the promptings of the Lord. And I'm looking forward to watching the rest of this world unfold.
Well, it's an exciting time, and we'll be talking to you later this week. God bless, and thanks so much, Joel.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, we're going to have Joel on our Genesis program later this week, and so I hope you'll be listening to all of our programs. Remember, you can listen to Radio Liberty 5 hours a day at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. If you want to know what we're really about, you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get a book that we have kept in print for many years. It's called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. Let me suggest my book, The AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. If you want to know why 500,000 people have died here in America unnecessarily, AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, I think, is the best book on the politics of AIDS, and it's, all of these are available. If you'd like to know more about them, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The July newsletter will be going out in a couple of days. It's completed, it's printed, and it's just a matter now of getting it mailed. And, of course, our August newsletter, I think you'll find fascinating. But right now, if you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, you can get the August newsletter. And, of course, remember the book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, Foundations, Their Power and Influence. And, of course, my interview with Norman Dodd, who was the director of research for the Reese Committee that investigated the Great Tax-Exempt Foundations. And then, of course, my book, AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic. And so, until tomorrow at the same time, pray for America, pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. May the Lord be with you.